from education to employment and everything in between.
It's a clearinghouse for all things shale.
This is the Shale Gas News with Bill DeRozier, Rusty Fender, and Matt Henderson.
Good morning and welcome to the Shale Gas News. I'm Bill DeRozier, calling in from my basement bunker somewhere in Dallas, Pennsylvania. Joining me via Skype in the studio, Rusty Fender. How are you, Rusty?
Hey, good morning, Bill. We're narrowing in with GPS on your bunker one of these days, so we're going to be knocking on your back door. So we're zeroing in with the GIS and GPS, Bill, so you're only safe for a while. But, you know, we thank you for phoning in. We're practicing safe radio here. Matt Henderson from our Williamsport Bureau will be along later in the program. He is also via Skype. I'm in the studio along with the master producer and CEO, the chief editing officer of the Bold Gold Radio Media Group, DC Taylor.
Yes.
D, how are you, buddy?
All right, good. We're gonna go have a party at Bill's house as soon as we find it.
We have the confetti ordered. We have cheap champagne. The champagne has been aging almost a week.
Yeah,
so,
almost. All right,
so
good.
We'll be at the DeRozier camp very soon, Bill, so that knock on the door may be us, just so you know.
Get ready.
Oh, I can't wait there. It's crazy times. I don't know if you guys caught the news story there earlier this week, but out west they had rolling blackouts. We've talked about that on the show at length the last 2 weeks. And then Colorado goes from, a heat wave of 90 degrees, and it dropped down to 30 degrees.
104 to 30. That's
four inches of snow or something like that. I don't – have you ever seen that before, Rusty?
No, not – they had a 67-degree temperature drop in 20 hours. Now, I've seen a lot of thermal inversions, they're called, in the weather terminology, but never anything like that. But, Denver, remember, Denver's the mile high city. It's a mile above. So things change there with such expediency that they wouldn't change at a lower altitude. So don't forget, you're high in the Rocky Mountains. So that certainly exacerbated that temperature change. But truly incredible. Interstate 5 closed all the way to Oregon. That was amazing, Bill.
It certainly is. Now, apparently it's not the first time there's been such a dramatic drop like that. I was reading, I want to say in the 50s or the 60s, right around Labor Day, they had a similar drop in snow coming that early. But the reason I bring it up, and people are probably trying to say, why are they even talking about this? But the reason I bring it up is simply this: with such a dramatic change, fossil fuels, especially natural gas, provide the energy we need to overcome such a scenario. We talk about it on the show all the time, but natural gas became a huge energy source out west to provide electricity during the high days, the high heat times. And it was also there when people needed to switch over to heating their homes. And that's what you get with a reliable energy source that's accessible and abundant in a place like Colorado, because they do have a large natural gas industry. The the energy industry, of course, is looking at this fall with bated breaths. We're 60 days away from the election, give or take. And now that we're talking about Colorado, I'm going to pull it up here on the computer while we're talking. But Colorado is a state that has a tremendous amount of oil and natural gas development. And as we've talked about on the program before, oil and natural gas account for so much of Colorado's budget every year for things like education and schools. And it's crazy to think that the state collected in 2018, Rusty, $102 million in taxes.
That's incredible.
From the federal-owned lands, which gets split between state and local governments, right?
Yeah,
these are real dollars.
You know, Bill, that was the original shale. They're shaling them their hill state, too. So they knew about this back in the 1940s and 50s. That was the original their shale in that area state.
And again, I just bring it up because Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee, recently was out in Pittsburgh, where he was trying to, correct or clarify his position on energy. But he has, over the last few months, said he wants to ban fracking, and then he wants to ban new drilling on federal and state-owned lands. And then when he was in Pittsburgh, he said, "I didn't mean that. Basically, I'm not going to ban fracking. There's a place for it." But yeah, that's real money when you think about it, Rusty. $102 million a year. Roughly, that's going to state or state, local, county sources of revenue? Like, where does a state come up with that kind of money if President or Vice President Joe Biden becomes president and shifts our energy dominance strategy away from fossil fuels?
Absolutely. And, you know, I always say too, Bill, you know, there's a caveat with this, because, you know, we know the adage, you gotta watch what you wish for, because all these folks who are Biden fans, you know, that heat their homes with natural gas, you limit fracking and you're going to send that price from 99 cents a cubic yard to like $3.99 like they do in New England. So again, you have to know who you're voting for. You have to know what they stand for, and you really have to know how that's going to affect you in your wallet, Bill.
It's something I am, you know, cognizant about. It's something that I personally do not want to see happen to this country, because we've done so many great things. Again, I think our focus should be in all of the above energy strategy, a strategy in which we look to promote and develop these resources in a fair and equal methodology. And our focus should be, again, on environmental considerations and making sure the industry is being as responsible as it possibly can, whether it be from an emissions standpoint or the environment itself where we're operating. I think all energy sources have an impact on the environment, and I think we need to do a better job as a society, and especially from a media standpoint, helping people understand that those impacts are that way. In fact, I recently read the book Superpower by Russell Gold. And this book, much like his previous book, The Boom, which focused on the development of the oil and gas industry as we know it today, Superpower focused on the development of the renewable energy industry, specifically wind. It does touch on solar. And what I found fascinating in that book, as we've all known, is much just like there are prime spots to develop shale oil and natural gas, there are prime spots to develop wind. Southwest Pennsylvania is actually a prized area. The panhandle of Texas and Oklahoma, prized areas. An area that does not develop very well in terms of wind, Southeast the United States, go figure. But what was fascinating about the book spends a great deal of time talking about the issues stopping solar and wind, mostly wind, from becoming a more dominant energy source. And the biggest thing that I got a kick out of, and you too, will too, Rusty, is transmission lines. So where we talk about on this show all the time, pipelines like Constitution, Atlantic Coast, Penn East, the wind energy industry has tried for years to build major interstate transmission line above ground power lines to bring essentially wind energy from the panhandle of Texas and Oklahoma east over to Memphis and Nashville, and then interconnect with the grids there to provide energy. And just about every state along that route had one reason or another to block it, even though you would think today's popular sentiment is we need more wind and solar. It's just fascinating to see how every state has a different opinion of how to possibly do that, and how, again, our desire to have more of these resources is actually the same thing that's stopping us from having them. Rusty, I don't know how much experience you have in wind and solar, but again, just the idea that transmission, whether it be for natural gas pipeline projects or for wind and solar projects, I just find it fascinating that remains the Achilles heel.
It's true. And, the problem with wind and solar, again, Bill, there's either little or no storage capacity. That's the problem. I know these giant windmills are backed up with, battery power and things like that. But, we talked about the entire Nassau and Suffolk County, Long Island area just to put a wind farm in that can power, just a city for like a half a day. So, we're really talking science fiction. There's more fiction here than science. But, as far as wind and solar, again, with them combined, where are you going with this? Not at the moment. You're going to need some type of storage capacity and some backup system when this thing goes down. So, it's nice to dream about the future, and it's come a long way in the last 100 years, but it's got a long way to go, Bill.
And as you were just saying, you got into a whole nother realm of discussion, battery backups and storage. What's neat is there are other ways to store energy, whether they're economical or efficient. One way would be, hydroelectric You know, it's an existing technology. You see it over in Europe and stuff, where you pump up water into an upper reservoir and then you open it up when you need the electricity, and it flows down and it creates electricity. Another thing I recently came across is simply just compressed air. When electricity is cheap, you know, at night, middle of the night, you start using that electricity to fill up canisters of air or nitrogen gas or something like that. And then you, when you need the electricity, you open that up and you allow it to turn a turbine or some sort of mechanical device that creates electricity. Again, I don't think it's as efficient, but I just wanted to highlight the fact that there are these innovative concepts out there in the world. And who knows, in the next 20 or 30 years, batteries as we know it, you know, the actual Duracells or whatever type of batteries, may not be the true batteries that we're using to, you know, balance our grid or create the electricity that we need. Have you come across any technology like that in your travels, Rusty?
Not particularly, but, you know, even the battery has come a long way. That's a really good point. I had to think for a second about that. But, you know, back in the early days of transportation, Bill, as you know, that the railroads were the first actual ships were the first transport, but rail came along after that and still is in use now. And all the crossing signals and semaphores and block signals along the railroad, as well as your crossing gates and lights, are all backed up in case of a power failure. You know, you never think about that, but if the power failure goes down in your area and the lights go out in a town and there's a train at 80 miles an hour coming through town, well, those gates aren't going to work. And people say, gee, I never really thought of that. Well, yeah, the gates and lights at your crossings are actually running off of DC storage batteries, not running off they're not running off alternating current from your utility poles. The utility pole generates charges the batteries, but all those signals and systems run off the batteries. And just in the last 30 years, they were still using nickel cadmium wet batteries, and I'm sure you're familiar with, Bill, that you'd have to add water to at the crossing or wherever these signals are. You have to add water as they would get hot, as the more they were used, and they would boil out and they would evaporate and they would condensate and go back again. They wouldn't have as much oomph as far as charging at the signals. Now we have all, you know, solid state current. We have batteries which are as big as big as your wallet that can run a crossing for hours and hours, but, you know, just as little as 25 years ago, and that's not all that far in the past, you had batteries as big as a car that had to be tended to almost on a weekly basis. So, you know, just in railroad technology alone, that's transportation related, Bill, we've seen it come a long way in a quarter century.
It is fascinating. And something we'll have to keep track of. I was catching up a friend of mine from the energy industry, somebody who used to build power plants, but now is building these types of projects. And I invited him on the show in the coming weeks to discuss some of that stuff we may or may not be aware of. And I just found it interesting. I got one more story here to talk about before we hit Fender's Fast Facts. Host of energy issues hang in the balance in down ticket races. S&P Global reports the 2020 election cycle has the potential to reshape environmental and energy issues across the federal landscape and state lines. At the state level, high-impact ballot measures face voter review on November 3rd, including proposals to mandate 50% renewable portfolio standards in places like Nevada, shake up to utility regulators in New Mexico by reducing the number of commissioners, making them appointed positions and elongating their tenure, and to change energy tax-related issues in Alaska and Louisiana. Energy environmental issues also play heavily in other several high-profile races for governor, state legislature, and key state commissioners. And I'd like to think people, especially here in Pennsylvania, take the time and the effort to analyze energy as a key voting reason. Unfortunately, I think more people focus on social issues and or popularity anymore. But again, on this show, we'll continue to bring it here. And Pennsylvania is a unique spot. We're a large state. We're not the largest state like Texas or Alaska or California or anything, but we're a large state and we have a lot of different areas in the state. I mean, in the Northeast, we have old coal land that has returned back into energy. USA, when you think about natural gas development, Pittsburgh area, old manufacturing area that's revitalized itself, also has a energy spectrum. I started talking out this segment about how Southwest PA is a prized area for solar and wind. And then you have the Philadelphia markets. And what I'm getting at is people, and we'll try to do our best on this show over the next couple of weeks, but people should pay attention to energy here in the state. because it's such an important issue for Pennsylvania, whether it be to tax our energy industry, whether it be to create REGI, the regional greenhouse gas emissions, or join REGI, I'm sorry, not create it, but join that coalition of states that have that in place, whether it be to impose more regulation on the oil and gas industry, or try to work with the industry to streamline its development, as evidenced by House Bill 732, the Local Resources Manufacturing Tax Credit. Pennsylvania is really at a crossroads of either helping the energy industry grow or preventing it from growing. And, Rusty, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. And, as far as energy goes now, I think that people, especially with climate change, especially now, we just talked about the Denver area, the High Rockies with a 67-70 degree change. I think more people are more cognizant of energy prices, of energy demand, of energy supply, where their energy is coming from. And of course, that hits home with, your wallets and your checkbooks and all that. But I think, I think out of what's the adage? Out of necessity comes, out of necessity comes change. And I think that now, due to a pandemic and a bunch of different things involved at the same time with this pandemic, I think that people are getting, at least now, getting kind of a jolt, a shock into the future of what energy is going to bring, Bill.
And I couldn't agree with you more, Rusty. Well, with that, why don't we jump into Fender's Fast Facts?
Okay, thanks, Bill. And on this very weekend back in 1894, diesel fuel was created by accident as a byproduct of gasoline, and for 7 years it was discarded. Amazing. Rudolf Diesel invented the first diesel engine this very weekend. It wasn't until 1911, sometime later, 1911, at the Paris World's Fair, that diesel fuel was debuted. Diesel fuel, as we all know, has a high flash point. It is a very, very safe fuel. You put a match in diesel fuel, the match will go out. It's not like gasoline. In fact, it is 10 times safer than gasoline and 100 times more stable as a liquid structure than gasoline. The EPA treats diesel engines the same as gasoline engines. They require diesel engines to meet the same standards as regular gasoline engines. Diesel fuel is better option at a higher altitudes. If you live in an altitude or drive at an altitude of over 1,000 feet, that's not a lot, 1,000 feet, there are fewer air molecules, so the ratio of air to fuel is a lot higher. Performance is greatly increased. Diesel fuel allows for longer trips with fewer stops. The average vehicle gets between 50 and 80 miles per gallon on the highway, and a full tank of diesel fuel can take a vehicle between 600 and 800 miles without refueling. So those tractor trailers, they drive across the country, they stop like twice. Yeah. Amazing. It is truly amazing. 800, almost 1,000 miles on that.
Wow.
And although Citroën, the famous car at one time, Citroën and Mercedes-Benz, were the first car companies in Europe to experiment with diesel engines, what was the first company in the United States to create and mass produce a diesel engine? And I'll take either the car company, even the car, even the model, and I'll tell you folks, it was in 1976. I would have said it was Volkswagen because I wanted to get a Volkswagen Rabbit, which was the one I thought was one of the first diesel cars, but it was not. So either the car company, the car, or the model, the first mass produced in 1976 diesel automobiles. Bill?
Oh, geez. Yeah, my guess was going to be the Volkswagen.
Me
heard
too.
So many people had
me
the Volkswagen
too.
Around there. But a diesel auto, well, I don't really have a guess. I'm going to say Ford because I drive a Ford truck.
Okay. DC?
I had a neighbor, I believe, that had a Oldsmobile Delta 88 with a diesel engine, which kind of was weird. I'm like, wow, I didn't know they did, because I was familiar with that in the little Volkswagens. So I'm going with that Oldsmobile.
Real, right on the money. As a matter of fact, either Buick or Delta. And I had a friend when I worked part-time at the A&P supermarket back in the in 1976 part-time. He had a Delta 88 and he had a diesel engine. It was actually Buick, but it was General Motors. The Buick Regal was the first, followed by the Oldsmobile Delta 88, but it was General Motors, the first mass-produced, very good, D, the first mass-produced production line car in the United States, the summer of 1976. And those are the fast facts about diesel fuel this week, Bill.
Well, Rusty, I appreciate it as always. We're going to take a quick break here on the Shale Gas News. When we return, we'll have the highlight reel from the recent Think About Energy briefing, which highlighted the environmental discussion regarding the energy industry here in Pennsylvania and how it's evolved over the last decade. Stay tuned for more after a word from our sponsors.
Why are natural gas pipelines important?
The most efficient and effective way to safely move natural gas is through a pipeline system.
We're constantly monitoring our systems and making sure that we're operating in the most reliable and, most importantly to me, the safest manner possible.
This system, over its life, is 99.9997% safe.
Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation, producing abundant opportunities.
It's always a good time for Greenlee's Barbecue.
For all your meat-eating needs.
Whole pork, ribs, brisket, chicken thighs, grilled chicken planks, ribeye steaks, salmon burgers, and beef burgers, plus salads and side dishes delivered or for catering at your weddings, company parties, and other crazy soirees, you crazy kids. GreenleesBBQ.com. Greenlee's Barbecue, Route 6, Tunkhannock. Look for the school bus next to Keystone Truck Caps. Greenlee's Barbecue.
Yeah, the benefits are very good. The benefits are all day one here. The dental health, vision, everything is top notch. Everything is very good.
Drivers wanted.
The 401k plan. We have a 6% matching program. The medical, there's a health spending account, and you could use that for co-pays. You could use that for prescription drugs. You could use that for anything just to help along with deductibles. And then you could put in from your paycheck, it's tax exempt. You could put in so much bi-weekly, and then that that helps out too because it is before taxes. So.
If you're looking for steady year-round work with a company that cares about you and your family, at GDS, you will drive locally and be home after every shift. Get all the details and advance your career with GDS, a division of Cabot Oil and Gas, where you'll drive the newest fleet on the road.
The steady schedule, the 4-2 schedule for a driver, a 4-2 schedule is great.
Gas Search Drilling Services. Get the phone number at gassearchdrilling.com.
Cabot Oil and Gas partners with the Weinberg Food Bank to battle food insecurity in Northeast PA.
It's the partnership of foundations and the companies like Cabot that really enable us to be successful.
Gene Brady, president of the Weinberg Food Bank.
We are very blessed. Those regions that have the presence of the gas industry in this area really enables us with things like Fill Glass with Hope, Hunter Share the Harvest, other donations that traditionally have been made to help food banks in their mission to end hunger in Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to the Shale Gas News. I'm DC Taylor, along with Bill DeRozier, Rusty Fender, and Matt Henderson. Every once in a while, we feature a Think About Energy briefing summary for you, and a recent one that they did, these are the webinars that they do. This one focused on how the natural gas industry has afforded the Appalachian Basin with economical and environmental benefits for over a decade. As the technologies continue to evolve, the industry has been at the forefront of implementing best management practices, best-in-class equipment, increased transparency, and environmental excellence. This webinar featured Joseph Reinhardt, shareholder at Babst-Calland, Patrick Henderson, Director of Regulatory Affairs for Marcellus Shale Coalition, and Catherine Klaber, Managing Partner of the Klaber Group. So here are some highlights from that Think About Energy briefing webinar now.
You know, I looked back to have a baseline from an activity standpoint compared to where we are here in 2020, a quick baseline on that. You know, we've got about 11,000 wells here in Pennsylvania. We're producing north of 6.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, making us the second largest producer. Well, back then in 2008, we had maybe 400 wells. We produced less than 4% of the natural gas back then as we are today. So really at the infancy and the foundation. The backdrop of Marcellus Shale was really at a time in hindsight, that was fortunate for the Commonwealth, because as the entire country and indeed the world was dealing and reeling with the Great Recession, there was a glimmer of hope, and that glimmer of hope was Marcellus Shale. I have here a reference to the $430 million in bonus payments that was received by the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources over the period of three lease sales in 2008 and 2009. To put in context, that's probably 5 to 7 times the total amount that had been generated by the state agency in prior 3 to 4 decades. So it was a number that certainly got their attention, and it got the attention of our elected officials. It got the attention of, at the time, Governor Rendell and our state legislative leaders that wanted to examine if there were future opportunities to also responsibly lease our state forest. And what does that hold for the opportunity for private landowners across Pennsylvania as well? And so you saw in the legislature and in the administration a significant focus on talking about a severance tax in Pennsylvania. Came kind of close to enactment. It passed one house in 2010. Couldn't quite get across the finish line from a policy proposal in 2010, but it was certainly front and center. And it was looked at from a few ways. One, parity with other states, ensuring that there's some revenue realized by the taxpayers of Pennsylvania. And again, two, providing the resources to the Commonwealth in light of the Great Recession and the deficits that were being faced by communities across Pennsylvania, to inject some revenue to address some of those shortfalls that we had seen. We're a water-rich state. We have, I think more than any other state in the nation, reliance upon private water wells and groundwater for our drinking water, particularly, of course, in rural areas. We drill more than 20,000 new water wells every single year in Pennsylvania, still do. Oil and gas in 2008 was a small bureau within DEP. They had 64 employees. They mostly dealt with legacy issues from our oil and natural gas drilling and development in northwestern Pennsylvania. Sort of had hummed along for a little while. And then all of a sudden, inundated with applications for drilling, for well pads, for pipelines, impoundments, all the activities that go along with a new and expanding industry. So there was a need to provide the resources there. We saw that early in 2010, again in 2013, and even more recently, where the permitting fees were raised, that revenue driven back to hire additional employees for DEP. And pipeline safety in 2011, the legislature passed Act 127, which ensured that our state agency, specifically our Public Utility Commission, had oversight and regulatory oversight to ensure the pipelines that are regulated at the federal level are done safely and responsibly, particularly those that were being built out in areas of the Commonwealth that had not seen prior development. One of the things that's critical to the industry and very proud of is the measurable progress on environmental compliance. You see that there, north of 98%. Hard to find an industry that has either a higher environmental compliance rate in Pennsylvania or is under the level of scrutiny as the oil and gas industry is. Over 19,000 inspections just last year, and yet a significant environmental compliance. Again, never satisfied until we get to 100, and we can always do better. But let's recognize the bar has been raised.
Yes, there were regulations, but I would say more often than not, we were getting ahead of the regulations as an industry. And that was what the regulators and what elected leaders, we were all pulling in the same direction. You know, what the industry understood early on and that the Marcellus Shale Coalition took on was an approach that really was a best practice, a recommended practice is what we called them. And it served so many purposes. First of all, it got, as new entrants were coming into Pennsylvania, it was a way to get everybody up to speed on what the lay of the land was physically, politically, and otherwise. And then we had some very technical, folks foci of some of these practices, and it allowed so many people throughout our member companies to work with each other on the really important technical issues of the day that were evolving, both in the regulatory arena, in the political arena, and then most importantly to us, within the member company. I had done a lot of work before coming to the Marcellus Shale Coalition on the issue of total dissolved solids in Pennsylvania's waterways, which had been a long problem with a lot of sources. But the last thing we wanted to do as a growing industry, and a very visible one, was to be kind of the last discharge in and cause problems that weren't all of our making, but we had the responsibility to not add to a pre-existing problem. And Secretary Crancer and I had a few very long conversations about how do we get this done quickly and get ahead of this issue. And I was thrilled at the leadership of the board of the Marcellus Shale Coalition when a resolution was put before them very quickly after the conversation with Secretary Crancer. We had a unanimous adoption to say, you know what? We're going to voluntarily eliminate any discharges of salty water, of total dissolved solids that are higher than POTWs were set to effectively treat. And we did that quickly, and we did it ahead of the curve, and frankly, never really got the kind of credit for it that I believe was due. But here, looking back, 10 years, I think it was one of the most impactful ways that the industry responded to the regulators. The regulators held the industry, to the standard we deserve to be held to. And that was a really excellent way of taking that issue off the table. And I think, no regrets on that whatsoever. So another unanimous board decision that said, yes, we will put voluntarily all the chemicals that are used in our work, up onto that database. To this day, it's incredibly detailed. And for people who really do want to understand the chemicals, there is so much there for that information. And again, very proud of taking that particular proactive solution.
When I was actually an attorney for the DEP, DER back in the 1980s, counseling the Bureau of Oil and Gas Management, there was a lot less interaction with the different bureaus than there is now. So operators now are dealing with not only the Oil and Gas Bureau, but the Air Quality Bureau, Clean Streams Group, Dam Safety Group, Solid Waste folks, and so on and so forth. So it really is becoming something where there's a comprehensive enforcement under all of these laws. Water management plans are now required under Section 3211. No person may withdraw or use water from any water source in Pennsylvania for the drilling or fracking of an unconventional natural gas well, except in accordance with the DEP-approved water management plan. And one of the big changes after Act 13 in terms of this particular provision is the statute talks about the restoration, the quality having to be meeting safe drinking water standards, or if the water quality supply exceeded those standards. That particular term has been defined in the regulations to mean that if it was better than safe drinking water standards, then the operator is required to try to restore the water quality to that. So I mentioned at the outset that we have several layers of regulation. So we've been talking about Pennsylvania DEP, the state, what they require. Of course, there's a host of requirements that would apply in the federal level as well, potentially to the operation of well sites and pipelines. And I've listed a number of them here. One in particular I'd like to note is PHMSA, which is the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. But particularly after the Robinson Township decision that was issued a few years ago by the Supreme Court, there is a lot of activity on the local level with regard to ordinances. Those ordinances not only purport to regulate operators, but they also authorize, as a matter of right, operations. Those particular ordinances are getting challenged these days by folks that don't want to have oil and gas activities in the area. And so on that level, there's a lot of activity on both sides of the fence. There's an organization called Stronger, State Review of Oil and Natural Gas Environmental Regulations. It was initially created in 1990 by EPA and the Interstate Oil Compact, which established guidelines for how one should regulate oil and gas waste by the member states. Since that time, in the late 90s, it was passed to a nonprofit organization that is a multi-stakeholder organization that expanded on those particular guidelines. Now, Pennsylvania has volunteered to have its program reviewed several times since the 1990s, including 2010, 2013, and 2015. You know, we talked about, Pat mentioned, have we made progress? Well, these are the conclusions that were drawn by Stronger. In 2010, after evaluating the EPA's hydraulic fracking program, they concluded that it was commended because of the fact that the department had done so much in terms of trying to prevent problems. That included tracking water withdrawals under the Water Resources Act, baseline water quality testing like pre-drill samples, identifying, you know, tracking waste that would be generated through Form 26R, and essentially encouraging source reduction and recycling. And then more recently in 2015, Stronger evaluated the Air Quality Bureau as it relates to Pennsylvania's oil and gas program. One of the things that they noted is that Pennsylvania was the first state to implement leak detection and repair requirements as part of the permitting process, standardized permitting process for oil and gas wells.
It's important, as this program says, to think about energy, to pause and not just simply, you know, give a reaction, but really think about it. And that's what your forum has enabled us to do. So I'm appreciative. And to the point that you just raised, George, about, a lot of promises were made by industry early on, but time needed to pass for those to play out. And I think that we can look back with pride in 2020 to a lot of promises kept and the track record that we've seen over the last 10, 12 years. And I think that just bolsters us going forward, that there's credibility there and integrity on the industry side as we look to build future opportunities.
That, again, just some highlights from a recent Think About Energy briefing webinar. You can actually find all these videos. You can follow them, subscribe to them. Think About Energy briefing. Just look for them on YouTube. And we will be back with more of the Shale Gas News. Stay tuned.
Do you know the power of America's energy security? Security that starts right here? The Marcellus Shale alone contains enough energy to meet our demand for the next 100 years. And that's just by today's estimates. If Pennsylvania were a country, it would be the fifth largest producer of natural gas in the world. All thanks to the incredible natural gas production right here in northeastern Pennsylvania. Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation, producing abundant opportunities.
Lindy Corporation is a pipeline and infrastructure company, and Lindy is proud to work in the Marcellus region, towns and cities, and beyond. Apply at lindyco.com. And remember, if Lindy wasn't hiring yesterday, chances are we will be hiring tomorrow.
Are you a truck driver looking to earn $1,000 to $2,100 a week with full benefits? Well, Eastern Freight Systems and Tunkhannock are seeking local, regional, and OTR drivers. They even have an oil field division with lanes based in both Tunkhannock and Pittston, PA. They're looking for motivated drivers who are looking to earn good money to join their team. A clean MVR with professional driver training or experience are required. Come join the growing team at Eastern Freight Systems by calling 570-836-8050.
If you're in construction or the gas industry, your team's getting it done 24 hours a day, and so is BX3. When you're working, so is BX3. They're your prime connection to parts, tools, and equipment rentals. If they don't have it at their Montrose or Tunkhannock locations, they'll find it for you somehow, some way. Trust me, they know people who know people. They're the relentless problem solvers. Call BX3 in Tunkhannock, 836-3000. In Montrose, it's 278-7000. Again, Tunkhannock, 836-3000, Montrose, 278-7368.
We've now been partnering for a couple of years with Cabot to provide what we call Fill a Glass with Hope. In this past year, we served hundreds of kids, and we provided nutritious milk in a quantity of 6,462 half gallons. We're grateful, as are the hundreds of children that are receiving the benefits of the program as a result of what Cabot and its partners do.
For more information, go to wellsaidcabot.com.
Welcome back to the Shale Gas News. Here's a review of some of the news stories that caught our eye this week. Biden could limit extractive industry on public lands, reversing Trump trend. S&P Global reports, extractive industry stakeholders, environmentalists are preparing for a potential Biden administration to move towards restrictive management of federal lands as the former vice president continues to lay out prospective policies to limit potential mining sites and projects. The fossil fuels and mining sectors have largely welcomed the current administration's efforts to roll back a number of Obama-era regulations as part of President Donald Trump's energy dominance focus. But November's election could put the industry oversight on a different path. Former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic Party's presidential nominee, has pledged to reinstate environmental regulations rescinded under the Trump administration, particularly those affecting the fossil fuel industries, if he defeats him. And that, of course, is a major concern for the energy industry, especially during these difficult times as companies are navigating supply and demand constraints and changes to the market on both domestic and global terms because of COVID and other factors. Liberty looks to dethrone Halliburton in oilfield service sector shakeup, oil price reports. Liberty Oilfield Services aims to become the largest provider of hydraulic fracturing services, replacing Halliburton at the top of the company's chief. The company's chief executive told Bloomberg in an interview, "Customer demand has told us to grow at this pace, and then deals like this come to us." Chris Wright said, "Our goal with this acquisition is to keep getting better, but to the extent we succeed at that, it probably leads us to being the leader sometime down the road." Schlumberger agreed to sell Liberty Oilfield Services, its U.S. fracking business, earlier this week in exchange for a minority stake of 37% of the resulting larger company. Trump and Biden race holds big oil policy impacts for shale and sanctions, S&P Global Platts reports. The U.S. presidential election in November presents a stark contrast for the next 4 years of U.S. oil policy that could shape supply and demand dynamics domestically and abroad, with the implications for shale, sanctions, trade, and OPEC relations. The greatest domestic impact could be from a promise by Democratic nominee Joe Biden to stop issuing drilling permits for federal lands and waters, which would shrink U.S. oil production by up to 2 million barrels per day by 2025, primarily from New Mexico's Delaware Basin and the Gulf of Mexico. And this would be disastrous for certain areas like New Mexico, which has come to embrace the revenues and the royalties and the economic investment in that state. A lot of people don't realize New Mexico is at the near the bottom of the list when it comes to economic development. It's not a major industrial center. It's not a major tech center. It's just a state that has struggled to find its way when it comes to its economy. And most recently, the development of this oil and gas resource out there has created a lot of opportunities that just didn't exist prior to that. And the Gulf of Mexico, of course, has been a major oil and gas production center for the country for a long time, and slowing that down will have negative impacts for many of the Gulf Coast states. U.S. oil and gas rig count rises by 3 to 285 heading into the last trimester of 2020. S&P Global reports the U.S. oil and gas rig count rose by 3 on the week to 285. Rig data provider Enverus said September 3rd, as the final trimester of the year approaches with the drilling area not showing much change. Two of the three rigs added this week were oil-focused, and then the other rig was a gas-focused rig. The biggest jump came from the Permian Basin in West Texas, New Mexico, which saw the increase of 4 rigs to 131 rigs, down from significantly higher numbers. And of course, rigs traditionally have been an indicator of oil and gas activity. They are the driving force of economic investment in the industry, but I don't think they are as important as they once were 10 years ago, especially when I started in this industry. The rig count was a big deal. Now with the technology that we have with horizontal drilling, allowing rigs to drill further and more efficiently, faster, if you will, the need for more rigs has shrunk because the rigs that are deployed now because of the technology are just able to do so much work. So a rig today might be equal to one or two or even three rigs a few years ago, and it's fascinating. FERC environmental report on PennEast gas pipe project comes under attack. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's favorable environmental assessment for the phased-in PennEast project generated hundreds of critical comments from environmental groups and residents opposed to one of the only large Northeast gas pipeline projects still pending at the commission. The roughly 118-mile-long, 1.1 billion cubic feet per day project originally intended to link Marcellus dry gas production with markets in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York has faced hurdles in New Jersey, and an appeals court ruling thwarted its ability to condemn lands in which the state held an interest. That project, like the Constitution Pipeline and some of the other projects in the Northeast, have come under a lot of scrutiny and attack, especially in the more progressive or liberal states. PennEast, of course, is trying to work its way across New Jersey. New Jersey's taken its lead from New York. New York has stopped the Constitution Pipeline and a few other projects from being built across its state. It's not a strong policy for economic development. It's not a good policy for consumers. These projects go before FERC for review, and they have to be deemed in the best interest of the public, whether it be from a supply standpoint or pricing standpoint, a heating standpoint in the winter, or even in the summer when we get hit with hot waves and we need the energy to balance our electrical grid and provide power for air conditioning, refrigeration, things like that. So this is a frustrating time for the energy industry that's trying to move this energy to the consumers that need it, especially in, along the East Coast and up in New England. But I hope that the PennEast project continues to move it forward. I think they've come up with some different options to get the project built out. As I mentioned in the article, a phased-in approach, and maybe that'll allow the project to at least get to some of the market while they work through the hurdles that they're dealing with. We're going to take a quick break here on the Shell Gas News. Stay tuned for more after a word from our sponsors.
SAFE, our natural gas pipelines.
Pipelines are the safest, most reliable way to move gas. In fact, you really can't move natural gas any other way. You can't get to a home. You can't get to a manufacturing facility without the use of a pipeline.
The amount of savings a customer is seeing is on average $2,000 a year. Think about that, $2,000 in savings.
Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation, producing abundant opportunities.
Environmental protection affects you no matter what industry you serve. Oso Wash provides the only certified clean solution you should trust for your vehicles. Oso is the only certified oil and gas industry clean tank washing facility in Northeast PA that's available 7 days a week. If it could get dirty, Oso can clean it. They're about 6 miles north of Tunkhannock off of Route 29 on Aldovan Road. 570-996-WASH and find them on Facebook. They are Oso Wash.
Are you looking for work in the gas industry? Lindy Corporation is always looking for good people. Apply at lindyco.com. Lindy installs water lines, sewer lines, and gas lines. We're busy in the Marcellus region. Apply for your next career at lindyco.com.
It's always a good time for Greenlee's Barbecue.
For all your meat-eating needs.
Resist the understandable urge to drink their award-winning sauces straight from the bottle.
Although if that's your thing, we won't judge.
Greenlee's bold and spicy Pure Rebel Sauce, Ozark Hillbilly Sauce, and sweet and tangy premium finishing sauce. Handcrafted and homemade.
Yummy.
You can order the sauces online and drool over the menu, too. Greenlee'sBBQ.com. Greenlee's Barbecue, Route 6, Tunkhannock. Look for the school bus next to Keystone Truck Caps. Greenlee's Barbecue.
Why choose Lackawanna College? Lackawanna College can give you the start you need. Spend 2 years earning your degree and go right to work earning a great salary. With 29 degree programs in competitive industries like culinary and hospitality management, petroleum and natural gas, and sonography, Lackawanna College can help you find your future. Visit lackawanna.edu for more information on how to apply or contact the admissions office at 570-961-7814. Why choose Lackawanna College? If you're looking to get ahead in your career or start a new one, Lackawanna College's Continuing Education Department offers a wide variety of certificate programs that are highly affordable and can help you get back to work quickly. Specialized training for workforce development and allied health careers is available, as well as the Lackawanna College Police Academy and the EMS Academy. Call 570-961-7813 for more information or visit lackawanna.edu. Find your future at Lackawanna College.
Cabot has been, you know, a fantastic corporate partner because they caught the vision. We have a goal to end hunger in Northeast Pennsylvania by 2025. Cabot's contribution is helping make that happen.
I live in Springville. I'm a landowner in Auburn Township. They've treated me with respect, my property with respect. They do an excellent job. Everything has been neat. There's never been anything out of place. Anything that they said they were going to do, they did. They came to you and told you what they were going to do. They gave you a timetable. They followed that timetable. Do not be afraid to invest with these people.
Industries like Cabot not only helped and lent their support to the Dietrich Theater, but they reached out and asked how they could help in other ways. Cabot has shown us that they want to invest in our community, that they're here to stay, and they want to support us for the long run.
For more information, go to wellsaidcabot.com.
Welcome back to the Shale Gas News. I'm DC Taylor, along with Bill DeRozier, Rusty Fender, and Matt Henderson. We'll get to the job segment coming up in just a couple of minutes. Right now, it's the top five. Each weekday, Marcellus Drilling News locates and shares news from the Marcellus and Utica Shale. Over 50,000 people read MDN each month, so we use it as a barometer to tell us which stories people find the most interesting. MDN editor Jim Willis compiles a list of the top stories each week. So once again, this week we have for you a summary of the top five most read stories on MDN over the past 7 days. And coming in at number five last week, some landowners sell royalty payments to third parties in Pennsylvania and Ohio. A few weeks ago, MDN told you about Peregrine Energy Partners buying royalty payments from landowners in Doddridge County, West Virginia. We have another purchase by Peregrine, this time in Monroe County, Ohio. Plus, a similar company that buys royalty interests has made its second such acquisition in the Marcellus Utica in Washington County, Pennsylvania. Peregrine has purchased more payment rights. This time in Ohio, the driller paying the royalties is Montage Resources, which recently announced it is selling itself to Southwestern Energy. This is the first time Peregrine has purchased royalty payment rights in the Ohio Utica. Plus, there's a new to us company in the same business, Rising Phoenix Royalties. They've purchased royalty payment rights from a private landowner in Washington County, Pennsylvania. The driller paying the royalties there is CNX Resources. Rusty?
Number four, the Gulfport, Ohio landowners settle a royalty lawsuit regarding monster Utica wells. Back in 2012, Gulfport Energy drilled a pair of exceptional Utica wells in Belmont County, Ohio, both on the same pad. The first was the Sugart 1-1H, which had an initial production rate of 20 million cubic feet of natural gas per day. It also produced an initial 144 barrels of condensate per day and 2,002 barrels of natural gas liquids per day. The second was the Sugart 1-1-2H well with an IP rate of 28.5 million cubic feet a day. Somewhere along the way, the Sugart family claimed Gulfport was making post-production royalty deductions it should not have taken. We searched our archives and our heads, and near as well can tell, we were not aware of this ongoing flap between the Sugart family trust and Gulfport over royalty deductions. Both sides agreed to arbitration, and in May of this year, the arbitrator issued a final decision. The arbitration settlement was not accepted by the Sugart family trust. Gulfport filed a follow-up lawsuit to enforce the arbitration settlement. As of yesterday, the Sugarts agreed to the settlement, closing the case, Steve.
All right. Number three, Sumitomo Corporation sells JV stake in Butler County, Pennsylvania, Marcellus. In 2010, gigantic Japanese trading house Sumitomo Corporation bought a 30% stake joint venture in Rex Energy's Marcellus drilling operation in Butler County, Pennsylvania for $150.7 million. Sumitomo wrote down much of the value for that purchase in 2015. In 2018, Rex went bankrupt, and now Penn Energy Resources owns and operates the Butler assets. Penn Energy is getting a new JV partner. Yesterday, Sumitomo announced the sale of their 30% share of the action. Sumitomo did not identify how much they sold the assets for, nor whom they sold them to.
Number two, a glimmer of hope for Utica Drilling in northeastern Ohio. Aubrey McClendon, then CEO of Chesapeake Energy, was the first major shale driller to recognize the promise of the Utica shale play in Ohio. He once famously said the Utica is the biggest thing to hit Ohio since the plow. While McClendon rightly deserves credit for launching the development of the Utica, he guessed wrong on the best places to drill in the Utica. The wells McClendon drilled as CEO of Chesapeake before he founded American Energy Partners were located in Carroll, Columbiana, Mahoning, and Stark counties. The core of the play ended up south of that location in counties like Harrison, Guernsey, Belmont, Noble, and Monroe. Drilling in the original northeastern Ohio Utica counties has pretty much dried up over the past half dozen years. Oh, there may be a well here and there drilled, but nothing like what happened south of there. We've had a number of northeastern Ohio landowners ask us over the years if drilling would ever return to the area. We now have an answer. None other than the Assistant Secretary for Fossil Energy in the U.S. Department of Energy, Steve Winberg, recently spoke to a reporter at the Warren Tribune Chronicle located in Trumbull County, northeastern Ohio, about the prospects of future drilling in northeastern Ohio. Winberg, in the area for a chamber breakfast, says shale drilling won't happen today or tomorrow in northeastern Ohio, but it will happen someday.
All right, the number one most popular story on MDN over the past week, Ohio injection well said to leak wastewater into wells 5 miles away. Officials with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, the ODNR, are investigating a claim that shale wastewater pumped into an injection well in Washington County, Ohio, is migrating and coming out of producing conventional natural gas wells some 5 miles away. A sudden increase in brine, naturally occurring water with lots of minerals from thousands of feet below the surface, began in late 2019. The gas well owners speculate the brine is coming from an injection well miles away. ODNR is investigating that claim. And those are your top five stories thousands of people read this past week on MDN. If you'd like to keep track of the headlines each day, it's easy. Just sign up for MDN's free daily email at marcellusdrilling.com/email. Now it's time for the job segment we do every week here on the Shale Gas News. It is brought to you by Lackawanna College and their School of Petroleum and Natural Gas. Lackawanna College, where you go to find your future. Rusty?
Thank you, Dee. And in Pennsylvania, UGI Utilities looking for a construction and maintenance laborer that's based in Oxford. SGS North America, a measurement technician opening, headquartered in Mansfield. Aegon Corporation looking for a construction laborer for their oil and gas pads out of Melvern, down in the Philadelphia area. New Pig Energy Corporation, a field technician out of Tyrone. Stantec, an opening for a mid to senior environmental FERC project manager headquartered in Pittsburgh. TC Energy, a measurement and regulation technician out of Masontown. JW Energy Company looking for a compression service technician headquartered in the northern tier of Towanda. Shale Pro Energy Services, a measurement technician opening out of Houston, and EQT Corporation, a flowback coordinator out of Waynesburg. Moving to Ohio, Viking Recruiting Resources, a gas compression technician for Akron, Central Ohio Technical College and Engineering Technology gas and oil instructor based in Newark, TRC Companies, a leak survey technician headquartered in Gahanna, Evolve Inc., looking for a gas and oil project superintendent for Lewis Center. SEM Group Corporation, a pipeliner trainee out of Oregon. That's Oregon, Ohio. EnLink Midstream, a crude hauler. That's out of Nashport. Purple Land Management, a title abstractor and a landman out of Canton. And DTE Energy, a natural gas operations maintenance technician headquartered in Dayton. Got a few in West Virginia. GMS Oil and Gas looking for a floor hand and a derrick hand out of Morgantown. DOSS, D-O-S-S, DOSS Enterprises, a construction dirt supervisor. It's out of Bridgeport. Team Fischel looking for foreman, plural, for the gas division out of Charleston. Black Rock Resources, a project support analyst out of Charleston. SWN, that's Southwest Energy, a field operator out of Jane Lou. TC Energy, a welder, AAA. Flux Core Stick Sheet of the Metal Arc, it's out of Elkins, and RDR Energy Resources, an electrician foreman, it's out of Clarksburg. Wrapping up with New York State, the New York Power Authority looking for an assistant gas scheduler out of White Plains, Westchester County. New York State Electric and Gas, a supervisor out of Oneonta, Kleinfelder Incorporated, a resident project representative for their natural gas unit out of Fishkill, New Fortress Energy, a logistics specialist for the entire Empire State of New York, and also for the whole state of New York, a specialist for electric power and natural gas power solutions. That's for the McKinsey and Company Corporation, and again for the entire state of New York. And those are the jobs this week, sponsored by Lackawanna College, the School of Petroleum and Natural Gas, Lackawanna College, where you go to find your future. And we thank you all for listening to the Shale Gas News here on a myriad of stations, Gem 104, and of course, TalkWilliamsport.com. We'll see you back here same time, same stations next week on the Shale Gas News. And thank you for listening. For Bill DeRosian, DC Taylor, Matt Henderson, I'm Rusty Fender. Thank you for listening to the Shale Gas News.